This is University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. I'm Dr. Jean Moore, host and executive producer of University Forum, bringing you a special tribute to Dr. James J. Fife, a former member of the Temple University Criminal Justice faculty, who died in November 2005. On March 19, 1999, I had the privilege and pleasure of interviewing Dr. Fife on University Forum. Today, I will repeat a recording of that program which demonstrates the character of this remarkable champion of true justice. Dr. Fife was a huge man in stature and in substance. A graduate of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, he received his doctorate from the State University of New York at Albany. He began his career as a New York City policeman, or, as you will hear him say in this program, as a cop. He returned to New York after leaving the faculty at Temple, teaching at his alma mater, John Jay College, and on leave from John Jay, was deputy commissioner for training in the Police Academy of the New York City Police Department. Listen now to Dr. James Fife's conversation with me on the University Forum program of March 19, 1999, our topic, The Justice in Criminal Justice. Welcome to the program, Dr. Fife.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
I'm delighted to have you. And Dr. Fife, you are far more than academically conversant with the criminal justice system. You started out in New York as a city cop, as they call it.
That's right. And I'm very proud to have been a cop. And in New York, that's a term we use with admiration.
And this was during the tumultuous 60s. And since then, it seems to me you've covered the waterfront, so to speak, not only in criminal justice research alone, but in affecting policies. How much justice is there in criminal justice, Dr. Fife?
Well, I think our system runs better than just about any other, but there are lots of inequities built into our society that really are reflected in the operations of the criminal justice system. So even if you have the most even-handed judges, police officers, and correctional officials, you find, for reasons that are beyond their control, that people of color more frequently wind up their clientele than anybody else.
Well, you're called as an expert to do a lot of the research and as well as to testify in extremely difficult situations and often involving those civil rights cases. What was your role in the civil rights litigation related to the beating by police of Rodney King?
Well, I didn't have a part in the local prosecution. I consulted with his attorneys in relation to the civil suit he had brought against the Los Angeles Police Department, which the city of Los Angeles couldn't settle too quickly. They wanted that to go away. But I also worked with the federal government on the prosecution that was successful. I provided them with some information, and I was to be their rebuttal witness at the end of the trial. But as I was leaving for the plane, they decided that the case was a lock, and I didn't actually testify in the case. But I worked with the Civil Rights Division on that.
That must have been very interesting, though.
Yeah, it was. And I had a lot of experience in Los Angeles prior to that. In fact, 4 or 5 years earlier, I testified in a beating case that the LAPD routinely overlooked that kind of conduct. And it was as though someone would have to be beaten up on TV before the police department would believe it.
Which is what happened.
Subsequently, that's what happened. Mm.
Yeah. Now, you've also been involved with the MOVE situation, which some may not know exactly what that was, you might want to explain.
Well, MOVE was a radical group that had some confrontations with the police here in Philly in 1978, and one of the individuals, several individuals, were arrested after the police sat outside the house for almost 2 months, and a police officer was killed during the confrontation with MOVE in 1978. Apparently by another police officer in an accidental shooting, not by anyone from the MOVE house. But people were arrested and convicted and sentenced to very long terms. MOVE started to demonstrate about that, and in 1984 and 85, really made a nuisance of themselves in a house in West Philly. And Mayor Good, I think, mishandled the situation. He directed the police to get rid of them. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, the 550 police officers showed up and gave the MOVE people 20 minutes to get out of the house, and they refused to do that. There followed a confrontation that went on for about 14 hours. It's been widely mischaracterized by the media. I found absolutely no evidence, for example, that the people in the MOVE house ever fired a single shot at the police or that they had any of the automatic weapons that were claimed. But around 6 o'clock in the evening, the Philadelphia police decided to end this confrontation by dropping a bomb on top of the house. And as most Philadelphians know, the house burned down. 64 homes, I believe, burned down. 260 people were made homeless. And 11 people, including five small children, were burned to death inside the MOVE house. And subsequently, that led to great reform in the Philadelphia Police Department. And in 1995, 96, I testified in a civil rights case brought by Ramona Africa and several other of the survivors against the Philadelphia Police Department.
And the outcomes of that case?
Well, the outcome was a real interesting one. The jury came down with a punitive verdict against the fire commissioner and the police commissioner that directed them to pay $2 a week to the MOVE survivors for 11 years, and which was how long it took for the case to reach trial. And that verdict, I thought, was really imaginative and not overly punitive, but it would certainly keep MOVE on the mind of the police commissioner and the fire commissioner. The judge set that aside, but he did uphold a verdict of $500,000 in damages for Ramona Africa and other folks. And there were other cases brought as a result of the bombing in which I did not testify. But in all, it cost the city of Philadelphia terribly in terms of reputation and prestige and in rebuilding that whole neighborhood.
Another case in another city, Waco.
Well, Waco, it's very interesting to me that MOVE has gotten so little attention and Waco has gotten so much, and I think there are a lot of reasons for that. But the Waco situation was very badly handled by the FBI, and it has a lot of parallels with MOVE. They wanted to arrest David Koresh, the very charismatic leader of this group, on charges that he was dealing with guns. And Mr. Koresh left that place, the compound, every Monday to jam with a rock and roll band. He regularly jogged. He drove a hot rod Camaro around. So it seemed to me that it was the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms people who wanted to arrest him, that they could have apprehended Mr. Koresh any Monday just by walking into the bar where he regularly played. But instead, they tried to assault this compound with knowledge that the Waco people knew that they were coming. And they became involved in a confrontation. And as we all recall, a siege that lasted about 55 days, and that ended in an attempt to assault the place and a terrible fire and the deaths of about 80 people, including lots of kids, most of whom apparently were killed by the Waco people themselves. But I was retained by the attorneys for survivors of the Waco disaster, and worked with them on the case for quite a while until the bombing in Oklahoma City. And there was clearly a link between the bombing in Oklahoma City and the Waco incident. The Waco bomb, or the Oklahoma City bombing, happened on the anniversary of the Waco incident, and it was to commemorate that in a very bizarre fashion. But after that happened, I started to realize that I didn't know who I was dealing with, and I dropped out of the Waco civil litigation. But I did testify before the U.S. Senate about my opinions on the actions of the ATF and of the FBI. And interestingly, the same guy ran both the Waco operation and the Ruby Ridge incident out in Idaho, where a woman was shot and killed by an FBI agent.
You mean the same person from the FBI?
Same person, a deputy director from the FBI. And one of the more bizarre pieces of the Waco incident and a very unusual coincidence was that on the day the fire took place, I had testified in a case in Phoenix, Arizona, on behalf of a police officer who shot a young man during a barricade situation. And on the witness stand on that morning in Phoenix, Arizona, was a former FBI agent who was testifying that the way to deal with folks like that was to avoid confrontation, and who used as an example the Waco incident and said, "We've been there for 55 days, and we would never do anything to provoke a confrontation." And he left the witness stand for his direct examination, went to lunch, and during the lunch hour, the FBI stormed the house at Waco. So when he came back for cross-examination, he had some pretty tough questions to answer. But in both cases, the same guy ran them. In Waco, he actually called for a portrait photographer to come out and be ready for the assault. And he had pictures of himself standing on a tank, holding two automatic weapons on his house with the Waco compound in flames behind him.
Now, you draw parallels between that and the MOVE situation, as well as a relationship to the Oklahoma bombing.
Well, I think the Philadelphia MOVE situation and the Waco situation were very much alike in the sense that they both involved cults, you know, groups that most people didn't understand, who were regarded as a nuisance by a lot of the neighbors, who may or may not have been involved in any criminal activity. The MOVE people, I don't believe, were. I think the only thing the MOVE people did was to annoy the neighbors, and they really were an annoyance. I mean, there's no question about that. But in both cases, instead of taking the easy way out and arresting people while they were out on the street, which both the MOVE people and Mr. Koresh in Waco did regularly, a massive show of force was mounted. There were 550 police officers at the MOVE incident. The police in Philadelphia fired between 8,000 and 10,000 shots into the MOVE house. And there's no evidence that a shot was ever fired at them in return.
So when you do that kind of investigative work, how do you get your data to show that there was nothing fired?
Well, you look at all the records and all the information. So, for example, if folks may remember that, I guess almost 20 years ago, the Los Angeles Police Department was involved in a blazing gun duel with the Symbionese Liberation Army, the folks who had kidnapped Patty Hearst. And when they went through the rubble of that house, they found 2,800 expended machine gun cartridges, which confirmed that the people in the house were using machine guns at them. What was found, there were no bullet holes found anywhere in the vicinity of the MOVE house, no evidence that any shots were fired. One police officer was hit, but he was facing the house, and he was shot in the back by a jacketed .38 caliber round, which almost certainly was fired by another cop. They found two single-shot rifles and a .38 caliber revolver in the house. The .38 had two expended cartridges in it, but the police department didn't bother to test to see whether they had been fired or whether they had just blown up in the inferno.
So what you're saying is that there was enough evidence there.
They never fired a shot. Mm-hmm. There were no automatic weapons recovered. There were no expended cartridges recovered. Mm-hmm. If you fire machine guns for hours and hours. And actually, for me, the best evidence that there was no machine gun in that house and no firing in that house was the claim by the police department that they dropped the bomb on the roof of the house because there was a bunker on the house that was being used as a machine gun nest. Now, I'm an ex-cop, and I don't think I'm that short of courage, but if you ask me to put a bomb in my lap and fly in a helicopter over a city street and hover 15 feet above a place where people were supposed to be using machine guns, you would have a hard time getting me to do that.
Yeah, that would raise a number of real questions.
Just on the face of it, I never believed that, and the physical evidence confirms that.
Dr. Fife, you're now much involved in looking at the things that are happening on the road. For many years, the black community well could have said that they were targets of being stopped while they're driving. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think the situation in New Jersey is the most interesting of the bunch. There have always been these claims, and whether they're accurate or not, I don't know. I know that I worked with some cops who were racist, and I'm sure that they were doing that. But the claim has always been there. But in New Jersey, I think it was really sustained. And I also worked on the case which was decided in Gloucester County about 3 years ago, in which a judge concluded that the police were stopping black motorists and trying to wheedle consent to search their cars out of them. The Jersey police in that case were involved in an operation called Operation Pipeline that was funded in part by the federal government, by the Drug Enforcement Administration. And it was designed to crack down on the transportation of drugs up and down the I-95 corridor. So police in every state were involved in it, but Jersey really took it, I think, too much to heart. One bit of evidence of that, for example, is that if you consider that I-95 runs from Miami through 9 hours of Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware before you get to Jersey. Then it runs through all of New England before you get to the top of it. The New Jersey State Police were making more arrests for drug transportation than any other agency. And the stretch of 95 that goes through Jersey is one of the shortest that runs through any state. What they were doing was pulling people over on the basis of race and really coercing them to allow them to search their cars. And if you think about that issue as well, the job of the state police on a road like 95 is to make sure that people don't speed, to make sure that the highway is safe, to record accidents, to deter traffic violations. But asking them to find out whether people possess drugs is really asking them to conduct illegal searches. And most municipal police chiefs know that when police officers make lots of arrests for purely possessory crimes, for putting drugs in their pocket or a gun in their belt, they're almost certainly conducting illegal searches because you can't find that out.
So what have you found that you feel really was the basis of these stops?
I'm sure it was race. Mm-hmm. John Lamberth, who was my colleague here and a psychologist at Temple University, did some very elaborate studies. And the short answer is that he found that 13% of the people who use that stretch of the turnpike are black. He went out and watched the turnpike. 13% of the people who speed are black. Black people don't speed any faster than white people. But everybody was pulled over for speeding, 58 and a 55 zone. He found that 13% of the people who are arrested for drunk driving are black. 13% of the people who are arrested for after accidents, for not having licenses or because they're found to be drunk are black. 13% of the people who are given tickets in basically non-discretionary radar situations where one officer clocks you and the other officer stops you are black. But about 75% of the people who are being arrested for transporting drugs were black. So there was a discrepancy there that you just couldn't explain, and that the New Jersey State Police didn't bother to explain because they said, even though we've conducted more training for this program than for any other in our history, we don't have any records of what we taught the officers. They claimed to have no curriculum, which was just a fantastic claim, and they claimed to have no data on who they stopped, and I don't believe either of those claims.
You're listening to University Forum. My guest, Dr. James Fife. Dr. Fife, let's go back a little bit to some of the extensive work that you've done in this whole area of training, because you've done some of the earliest work in it, and some of the rules of shooting a fleeing felon. Would you talk about that?
Sure. When I first became a police officer, the police in New York and most other states were authorized to shoot for two reasons. One was to defend lives, and the other was to apprehend people who had committed felonies and who would otherwise get away. And that's a rule that comes to us from the Middle Ages, when all felonies were capital offenses. If you were convicted of a felony, first of all, you went to a kangaroo court. You were going to be convicted. You didn't get Miranda rights or anything else. If you were convicted, you would be executed. But we've changed, and most felonies now, only a tiny number of felonies are subject to the death penalty. But what we were doing was allowing the police, who merely suspected people of committing crimes like stealing an expensive 10-speed or cashing a rubber check or siphoning gasoline from a car, one case I worked on, we were allowing the police, who merely suspected people of those offenses, to shoot and kill people. And in 1979, I began work with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund on cases in which they were trying to strike that rule. And the rule then existed in 1979 in 25 of the states. And I had done research that showed that eliminating the rule, as New York had done, had no effect at all on public safety or on the safety of the police or crime rates. And in fact, eliminating it and training the police officers to use their guns with care reduced the number of shootings very dramatically. So, and obviously reduced tensions between the police and the community as well. So in 1985, the Supreme Court decided the case that made it there. It involved a young man named Edward Garner, who was shot by a Memphis police officer after he was fleeing from a neighbor's house where he had stolen $10. And the officer testified that Garner was not armed. I could see both of his hands, but I couldn't apprehend him by any other means except shooting him. And I did. He died. I didn't intend to kill him. I intended to stop him. But what the Supreme Court ruled was a very unusual ruling. It ruled that that use of force to apprehend him was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It was they ruled that a shooting was a seizure, that it was an unreasonable way of seizing him. So the law has changed since 1985, and police are no longer permitted to engage in that kind of conduct.
Well, you've been into a lot of other areas, too. We just have just a brief time to touch some of them. The domestic abuse.
Well, the domestic abuse case in which I should give some background on that. When I became a cop, I was trained not to make arrests in domestic abuse cases. And I guess there was a sexist motive there, but the logic that I was taught was that you don't want to be the one who wrecks a home. And if you go into a home and have drag the old man out in front of his wife and kids, you've effectively destroyed the family unit. So that was a sexist point of view, and maybe some of those family units should have been destroyed. But over the years, largely through the efforts of feminist groups, the police began to see that in a different light. And in 1983, I testified in a case called Thurman versus Tarrington in Connecticut, and that involved a young woman whose estranged husband was the subject of a protection order, but he assaulted her 13 times in cases in which the police were called and they had done nothing. And finally, he cut her up very severely. And she brought a suit against the Tarrington, Connecticut Police Department, alleging that their failure to arrest him on her request was a denial of her right to equal protection of law. And what the court in Connecticut ruled, the federal court ruled for the first time, was that abused spouses are a class, like black people or gay people, and denying them the services of the law on the basis of their membership in that class was a constitutional violation. So that sent quite a message out to the cops. The Tarrington police were held liable for about $3 million in the case, and it was the first time that a police department had been held liable on anything like that. And it resulted, along with some research that was done, that showed that arrest was probably a better way of dealing with these situations than trying to play social worker. It resulted in changes in police practice across the country.
That's a hallmark case.
Yeah, it is. And it's one I'm very proud to have been a part of.
Now, another area, the use of attack dogs by the police.
Well, most people, that's a problem area, because most people think of police dogs as Rin-Tin-Tin and nice dogs, and they've all seen the TV shows. A lot of black folks have different memories. They remember Bull Connor and Selma and the Edmund Pettus Bridge in the early 1960s. Under Chief Gates in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Police Department really began using dogs to chew people up, and I became involved in several cases in Southern California. And what was interesting was that at the time I became involved in these in the late early 80s and early 90s, the 13 or so dog handlers in the Los Angeles Police Department were putting more people in the hospital every year than the other 7,987 officers of the police department combined. And finally, a class action suit was brought, and the LAPD, under Willie Williams was appalled at what the police were doing out there. And under Willie Williams, the department changed its policies. But they were chewing up people when there was no reason to do it. It's one thing to put a dog on someone who was trying to kill a police officer or was violent, but these were cases involving typically kids in stolen cars who had given up or nonviolent offenders. It was very rare that a dog was used on a violent offender, and it was absolutely gratuitous. And the injuries, people don't realize the injuries that a dog bite can cause. I've testified in cases where dogs have bitten off people's noses, ears, torn out muscles, whole calf muscles, bicep muscles, so they're really permanently maiming injuries. We're not talking about minor injuries in these cases.
So the use of police dogs now in that area as far as attack is
It's changed quite a bit, and a big part of the issue here, a lot of the dogs came into police work as the Cold War ended, and a lot of these dogs were being trained by private breeders who were training them to guard nuclear facilities. And when they ran out of nuclear facilities to guard, they started selling the same dogs to the police. And a lot of the dogs in L.A. were actually bought from the former East German police, where they had been used on the Berlin Wall. So, you know, it's kind of appalling to me that you would take a dog off the Brandenburg Gate and bring him to the streets of Los Angeles to police a democracy.
So there's more restraint now.
Right? No, Willie Williams, I have to credit. I did analyses where we found that the dogs were biting about 65% of the people they helped to apprehend. And half of those bites were very, very serious bites. And that amounted to about 150 a year.
So your analysis and your research really was very helpful in changing that.
Well, I like to think so. Mm-hmm. But when Willie Williams testified in the case, he was asked what the bite rate was. And he said it's about 10 or 11%. And someone said, well, how can that be? Fife has found that it was 65%. Well, it was until I found out about it. And
oh, okay.
I put an end to it.
Yeah.
And they don't hospitalize anybody anymore.
Let me ask you, as we're beginning to wind down, something about police corruption. How much of this have you found in your various areas as you researched?
When I first became a cop in New York City, it was very widespread, but it was sort of benign. It mostly consisted of police officers eating free meals and taking money from gamblers and from stores that were open on Sunday and were violating the Sunday Blue Laws. So it was not... I don't want to make light of it, but it was not terribly evil stuff. And what most police departments have done since then is really put an end to that kind of misconduct, so that the corruption you do have involves far fewer officers, but it's really awful stuff, like the 39th District cases, for example, where police officers were framing individuals and stealing drugs and selling drugs. So it exists to some degree in all municipal police departments. It's very hard to control. In most places, it's not systemic. It involves a few bad guys, as happened here, and as happened in New York most recently.
But now you've put a lot of emphasis on the importance of training and education for police.
Yeah, I think cops should be educated before they come into the job. And one reason for that is that you really want people in policing who choose to become police officers. And you want people who are at least as skilled as, for example, an FBI agent, because doing the police job well is at least as difficult as doing an FBI agent's job well.
And you have your own training in John Jay College at the undergraduate level and advanced degrees from State University of New York at Albany.
Right.
So you yourself have had much of that kind of training and background, and now you're into the professorial ranks.
Oh, yeah.
I understand that your wife also is in the criminal justice field.
My wife teaches at Rutgers in Newark, and her interest is in the courts and prosecution.
Well, as you look back over what is now a really illustrious career, having come as the first male in your family not only to go to college, but really the first to finish high school, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
What is your most satisfying moment?
Oh, I guess it would have to be Garner, the Memphis case in which we put an end to the fleeing felon rule. I think if I have a hallmark achievement, that's the one I'm most proud of.
Dr. James Fife, thank you so much for being my guest on University Forum and helping to put the justice back into criminal justice. You've been listening to a program recorded March 19th, 1999, with Dr. James Fife, former member of the criminal justice faculty of Temple University, who died in November of 2005. At the time of his death, Dr. Fife was Deputy Commissioner for Training for the Police Academy of the Police Department of New York City. I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@temple.edu, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.